Good afternoon. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time's 7 minutes after 1 p.m., 9 minutes after 1 p.m., March 27, 2012. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, and Senator McGuire. Today is going to be Senate Bill 192, Oil and Gas Production. And this afternoon, we're going to first start by finishing a presentation from the Department of Natural Resources regarding leases and requirements and facility constraints, followed by a presentation on progressivity dealing with oil tax structure by PFC Energy. And with that, I'd like to have Mr. Bill Barron come forward, please, Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. I think you're on page 6. And maybe you can start by introducing yourself for the record, who you represent, and then maybe give the public a brief explanation of what you're doing, because we're dropping into the, you know, the beginning of this presentation.
Certainly. For the record, I'm Bill Barron, and I'm the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas for the state of Alaska. And thanks for having me back so we can get back to where we started yesterday. Just for a general broad brush follow-up from yesterday, what we were talking about was the ways and means the state has the ability to dispose of land, and the primary aspects of land disposition are through the area-wide lease sale, and we kind of generally talked about some of the terms and conditions, the bonus programs, the rental programs that are currently in effect for last year, at the end of the year, for North Slope, and that going forward for the Cook Inlet. And we then were about to start into a single slide on the other opportunity for land disposition, and that being the exploration license system. Now, just for general background, the exploration licensing system is for areas that are not within the area-wide lease sale. So again, we've got the two programs are distinct and separate. In this program, there are no rental fees or upfront bonus programs. The term for basically the concession is for 10 years. And in that 10 years, the program is based on a basis that companies or a company would come forward, designate an area of interest, primarily an oil and gas basin that they believe to be prospective. And they would propose a designated work program, not necessarily in terms of the activities that will take place, but in terms of the financial commitment that they will make. And that is the term of the exploration license. That license, 25% of their fiscal commitment has to be completed within the first 4 years, or the license can be revoked. After the 10-year time frame, any of the leases that are, or any of the area within the exploration license, can be converted to a lease or multiple leases for another 5-year term. That would be another extension of the program, primarily for additional exploration, delineation, and hopefully progressing the property into the form of a unit, and then on into the participating areas and on into development. We only have 4 of those areas at current time, 2 in the Susitna area, 1 in the Nana, and 1 near Healy. So it's, while the program is there, it's not widely used. The area-wide lease sale is much more honed for the exploration of oil and gas in the state. So let's talk a little bit about the current status of the leases that are currently out in the ownership of the various companies. Now, this does not include the December 2011 lease sale on the North Slope. Most of those leases have yet to be adjudicated, so they are still within the confines of the state's ownership. However, all the other acres, all total, we have 1,416 leases. The largest tract we've got is 9 square miles. And the reason why I put the 9 square miles out there for the view is we have leased as small as 1 square mile. Statutorily, 9 square miles is the largest we can put up for lease. Now, let's just for comparison purposes, many of the international arenas have blocks. And a block in many of those countries can be as many as 180 to 190 square miles in one single, basically one single lease in their definition. So it's a significant difference of understanding when we're talking about concessions in international regimes and what we do in Alaska. So, for example, a single block, if it is 180 square miles, is roughly half of the size of Prudhoe Bay. That would be the one block of a concession. And many countries package blocks together. They can have as many as 4, 5, 6 different blocks all offered at the same time. So it's a completely different kind of function as we work our way through this. Of the 1,416 leases, 46% of these leases are within units and are producing. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that every lease is producing, but the lease is part of a unit which is under production. A very small amount, 0.5% of the leases, are producing, but they're not within units. It's a very unusual case, not really a big deal. Now, the next percentage is going to probably raise a few questions. 46% of the leases are held by companies who are, in one way or another, actively exploring part of their leasehold. Let me give you an example. Apache. Apache picked up a fairly sizable number of tracts in the Cook Inlet lease sale last year. They are aggressively doing seismic work. So all of their acres are part of that 46%. Are they actively drilling on every one of their acres? No. Are they shooting seismic today on all those acres? No. What they're doing is they're systematically shooting seismic, and they will eventually cover all of their tracks. So the 46% that I referenced there is simply a way of trying to describe that companies are progressing work. But they're not progressing work necessarily on every single track that they might have, but they are making their way through the activity. Now, that leaves 7.5% that we have identified that may or may not be under any active exploration. Interestingly enough, 95% of those, which is a very small number, again, 7.5%, 95% of those are held by either individuals or groups of individuals, not major corporations. Again, let's talk up a little bit about acreage and who holds acres and why would they secure acres. Again, the lease terms that we have are a competitive base. Statutorily, we kind of like to say if you're 18-year-old and breathing, you too can own a lease in Alaska. You know, there are some people that find that objectionable. There are others that absolutely celebrate that opportunity. There are many different kinds of companies in the oil industry. There are some that are primarily exploration, have a paradigm of exploration. There are some that have a primary paradigm of development. And there's others that have a primary function corporately of what we call brownfield operations. So on one hand, you have the explorers and the early developers, and that's greenfield. And at the other end of the spectrum, once the field becomes very mature, you have brownfield operations. The advantage to some of these people, the what some people call speculators, some of these are individuals and some of these are corporations. They actually serve a very critical function in the role in lease sales. These are people who come in and actively purchase leases and then aggressively market those leases to other players. a very good example of somebody that would be in this mode historically would be Armstrong. Armstrong has picked up many leases in the North Slope and many leases in the Kenai Peninsula. And because of their ability to market the land that they secured from us, they have brought players in like Repsol, Pioneer, E&I, and they're actually doing development work themselves in the Kenai Peninsula. So while this kind of company tends to be very much focused on land management rather than direct drilling and operations, they serve a very valuable function within the prospects of state development of its oil and gas. So again, 1,416 acres, and most of it, by the way, we would pull the percentages together, are being actively worked one way or another.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question regarding that, and in reference to the previous page, it says licensee on page 6, says licensee must commit 25% of total specified work commitment by fourth anniversary of license issuance. So could a work commitment be there to pursue the sale of the lease? Is that a work commitment, or does a work commitment mean that they have to commit to some kind of exploration and or drilling?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, the slide that you're referring to is for exploration licenses.
Mm-hmm.
The work commitment is not necessarily associated with the area-wide lease sale. So to answer your question, or let me try and repackage the question so I'll make sure I understand it. You're asking, can work commitments be part of a lease sale opportunity? The answer to that is yes. We tapped on it just a little bit yesterday. The state does have the ability to specify work commitments during the exploration phase as part of the original bid. In fact, we've done that as recently as last year in the Cook Inlet with the Cosmopolitan Unit, where we knew there were hydrocarbons. A well had historically been drilled and tested, so we knew there was an oil base. We packaged up several leases together, and the requirement was you had to bid on those leases in combination with each other, and then over a period of time you had to identify and drill, suspend, or PA a well within that area. So that was the kind of work commitment that we put together there. Right now the idea of having a work commitment as part of the bid, while that might have some interest and some dialogue needs to be held around that, having the entire idea of having an idea of what you're going to do even before you win the bid is a bit problematic. From a perspective of these are competitively bid acres, and if you don't know what you're going to win, how do you put together a work program before you know what you're going to win, or whether or not you even have much prospectivity in the area that you're trying to develop? So it's a very difficult, complicated question to try and get your head around.
Just a short follow-up. Well, I think that might be probably part of the problem. I would almost assume, and I realize what you just said, that it's helpful to have people there that are speculating, I guess, because they help promote what takes place. But it would seem to me that most people that would show an interest or should show an interest, and this comes somewhat maybe from the situation that when we visited Norway, is the concept that people that are looking to develop oil properties or gas properties would be the people that would actually come to a lease sale, not people that are able to just come and bid on land and then hold on to that land for I'm not sure what period of time, because I was almost merging the two together, the licensing system for exploration and the status and leases. I would thought that they were almost one in the same, that you would have to have some concept of what you were going to do rather than just speculate. So with that thought in mind, what is required of somebody, when are they required to deliver a plan of work or development? Just briefly.
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Senator Thomas. Clearly, in an exploration license basis, the company comes to the state and identifies again, financially what they're going to spend on a property, not necessarily what kind of work. In the current leasing program that we've got, what we've tried to do as a state is identify that in a 10-year time frame, which is what the last lease sale allowed for, the first 7 years they pay a rental basis for the property, and after that time, years 8, 9, and 10, to try and encourage that business model. If no work or very little work has been done, again, as we described yesterday, the rental rates ratchet up significantly. That was our attempt to try and get companies of interest to perform work or to form consortiums or to gain more land mass through working closer together with other parties to establish an area that they feel like they can develop. Again, there is a possibility of blending the two. But that is not where we are today. And that's what I'm trying to do is explain the system we have today and think our way through, is there a way to blend the two down the road? And the answer is possibly. But again, the idea that people can come in, and some of these are individuals, some of them are people that, many people that you actually know yourself, buy the acres, and then try and market those acres to somebody who can then, or they try and market it so they can get money to go out and do the exploration. If we were to have not only a system that required a bid to win, but also some sort of assured financial commitment, that could very much begin to limit the players that would be willing to play in the oil and gas sector. Now, To some regard, that might be a good thing. To somebody else, it may not be. So again, it's how do you package that so that you try and encourage as many people, broad brush, and companies as you can to come into the state. At the same time, encourage and try and support the exploration efforts of companies to try and drive them into a place where once they have the discovery, then they move quickly on into development. That's the model that we're working for.
That's good enough. Thank you.
Go ahead and continue. Could we turn down the mics, please? I don't know. We're getting a back feed. Go ahead and continue.
All right. Thank you very much. So once we've gone through our primary exploration activity, let's assume that we've been successful. We always kind of like the success branch of that decision tree. We've now got a discovery, and it has been proven to have sustained production, it has been proven to have movable hydrocarbons, so a unit is formed. The process or the purpose of forming a unit is for the protection of all parties associated with the reservoir. A lot of times those reservoirs cross over lease boundaries, and so multiple players have to be brought in, even if they didn't have the discovery well on their property. An acreage play gets pulled in and they become part of a unit. A participating area, or PA, is formed once there's sustained production from the wells. And a separate participating area, or PA again, is required for each producing horizon within the unit. And let's see, the PA does several things, and one of which is sets out the proportions for cost and revenues for all the people associated within that PA and unit. Again, it's primarily driven for the protection of all parties, including the state. So now we've got a unit, we've got a PA, and this is where we first really sit down and have the discussion of plans of development. And a plan of development is required for every PA. These are annually submitted and reviewed by the Division of Oil and Gas. And we do, and we've got several upcoming slides on just the process. But if we deem the POD to be...
We'll do is we'll accelerate through some of this stuff.
Okay.
Because what we're going to concentrate on is some of the numerics dealing with budget issues, and some of this stuff is more geared towards resources.
Very good, sir.
So we'll try to go faster through the resource stuff and slower when we get into the money.
Not a problem. Okay, so let's, as you say, let's just plow through the POD kind of stuff. Just for general purposes and interest, on the North Slope, there are 18 existing units, 42 PAs, and two units are being proposed. So this just kind of gives you a scale of how many there are. Again, I've offered up a process flow diagram for your future reference, because this is just kind of the process that we would go through in looking at plans of development. Mechanically, the state employs a couple of tools. One is which is a score sheet or a general matrix that we compare past PODs with, and what we affectionately call our bubble map. And through that bubble map, we identify areas, in this case, of concern or interest that we would like the company to target a little bit closer. And the next exhibit is, this is Kaparik, is a wonderful bubble map, a wonderful picture of a classic line drive water flood reservoir. And just, you can very clearly see the lines and where the water is pushing the oil to producers. And if you've noticed the little area down in the lower left-hand corner, seems to be a bit devoid of any bubbles. That was a concern of ours as a state, and after several dialogues with ConocoPhillips, they did drill Shark's Tooth this winter. That is a confidential well. We haven't even seen the logs yet, but the well was drilled earlier this year. So it's that kind of process, that recognition by both the state and the companies that areas of interest and future development. Just to give you an example of how reservoirs are stacked on top of each other, this is an exhibit of Prudhoe Bay, and the large unit, the IPA, the initial participating area, and the several PAs above and below the primary field. So again, PAs can be stacked on top of each other for every producing horizon. Again, we've talked about Orion and Borealis and the general bubble map for the IPA. Again, these are examples of areas that we are in constant discussions with the operator on future development and directionally the plans that they've got to increase production and expand their developed area. So we're moving into the dialogue of production and production facilities. Trying to give you a little bit of a technical background before we plow too far ahead. There's been a lot of discussion about facilities, facility constraints, future development, and future operations. A lot of people will say, well, surely you've got excess capacity in your system. The pipeline used to have 2 million barrels a day. We're now down to 600,000. Clearly, you've got excess capacity. The next series of exhibits I'll offer up is as a way of looking at this in terms of in the original phase or development of any oil and gas property, you put in certain facilities that handle fluids in a certain manner. If you put in a 1,000 barrel a day facility, if originally 900 barrels is oil and 100 barrels is water going through that facility, it's still 1,000 barrels. At the end of the life of the field, you may have 100 barrels of oil and 900 barrels of water. It's still 1,000 barrels. That vessel is still only going to be able to handle 1,000 barrels. So if you look at the next series of curves, and this is Prudhoe Bay, clearly the oil is declining, but interestingly enough, if you look at the blue line, that is water production. So if you add the two together, The production total throughput of oil and water has basically remained constant since 2000. Now, it did come off a little bit. Now, then the question is going to be, well, what else could be impacting that? Clearly, we've got some excess capacity there. Well, the other thing that we have to do is we have to recognize that we're handling more gas as well. So again, if you look at the water-oil ratio on the top curve and the gas-oil ratio, You can see that there's more gas being produced from having to be processed as Prudhoe Bay continues to inject gas for pressure maintenance and for their and more water for their water flood. So, in fact, a lot of these facilities that are currently in Prudhoe Bay are limited in capacity by either water or by handling gas. And the reservoir engineers at, responsible for Prudhoe Bay have actually done an amazing job in the overall development and asset allocation for that field. It's an amazing property where originally people thought you were going to have 30% recovery. You're now approaching 60% recovery. It's amazing to watch that process. And they have very sophisticated reservoir simulation tools that they look out in future and see which wells are going to begin to give them either more water or more gas. And the gassier wells, they begin to shut in. And that way, they don't necessarily have to make a lot of capital investments in facility upgrades or debottlenecking. They actually can maneuver which wells they turn on or turn off, and they can actually predict which ones those will be, and then conduct workovers and recompletions to account for that. Same thing with Kuparuk. Again, North America's second largest oil field. This is a very typical curve. Again, the oil in green and the water in blue. And again, it's very reminiscent of the Prudhoe curve that I'm showing you again. So it's very, very similar.
Right, Mr. Barron, it looks like if we go back to 20, which is the Prudhoe curve.
Yes, sir.
Looks like a kind of a definition of a parabolic curve. The green line from 87 on doesn't appear to be flattening.
Flattening in the last 3 or 4 years? Is that what you're referring
yes.
to? No, actually, that is, from a technical perspective, this plot is from an engineer's perspective, is drawn incorrectly. The y-axis for a decline curve should be a log curve instead of a Cartesian curve. In a semi-log presentation, that would be very close to a straight line. So what you're seeing is it's just a matter of mathematics. Is it does look like it's flattening, but in fact the decline is almost straight line, what they call a straight line depression. So if we were to replicate that with a log curve, it would show significantly different, and I'd be happy to send you a note on that to the committee.
Yeah, if you could maybe put the oil production both in logarithmic and nominal scale.
Yes, sir. Be happy.
Same with the Kuparuk chart.
Same thing with the Kuparuk.
On 23.
Be happy to. So again, if you look at, again, from a facility limitation standpoint, you look at Kuparuk, and you're seeing something, the same, very similar story. That seems to have trailed off a little bit. But again, now if you look at gas handling, again, the gas oil ratio is beginning to elevate along with the water oil ratio. Again, what I'm describing to you is I could take the names off these fields, and this would be almost exactly what you would see in any primary conventional oil and gas field almost anywhere in the world. Not necessarily shale. Shale would have a different look to it, but this is a very typical straight line decline curve analysis that would be in any field. And the oil decrease with the gas increase, water increase with water flood, this would be very typical of other fields throughout the world.
And if we backed up in time, when would you have been able to draw that conclusion? 5 years ago or 10 years ago? Or
Okay, let's back up to the Prudhoe curve. That curve, as far as what the decline would have been, could have been predicted as early as 89, 90. That would have been the inception of the curve.
Okay. And this would be most likely expected when they opened the basin?
Pardon?
This most likely would be expected when they opened the basin, you're going to have a decline curve?
Absolutely. Chairman, if you are in a conventional sandstone reservoir, this is a curve that you would be able to predict. Now, how much of that decline? Is it going to be an 8% decline, a 6% decline? you know, your field is going to tell you that. You're going to have to let the field kind of manage itself. But statistically, you could do what a lot of engineers call type curve matching, and you could have done a type curve match. And what that means is you've got other models of other fields with similar reservoir characteristics. And, yes, you could have predicted the flat section early on, the plateau, and then you could have predicted some sort of rate of decline over time. Now, the rate of decline is – yes, sir?
You use the word type curve?
Type curve analysis. Okay. We're getting really off into the technical side there if we get too far down that path.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think some people were surprised that we're at a decline curve point we are today in the public.
That's very true. So from a reservoir is...
Just a second. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly here, we're looking at the two pages, 21 and 24, and it has the total liquids and total liquids oil plus water production. And I took the year 93 just for convenience. And if you add those two together, we have a total of 3.2 million barrels of oil and water being produced at that point in time.
In 93, I show 2.5 million. Are you talking Kuparuk as well?
Yes.
Okay. I won't argue the numbers.
Okay. So is the gas having the other effect on this to limit it to that as being almost like the maximum? Is that why it flattens out, one drops off, the other one flattens out, and realistically that seems to be like the limit potential?
Yes, sir, that's correct. If you look at slide 22, for Prudhoe, that is indicative of as your gas begins to elevate, again, you've got gas handling limitations in some of the facilities as well as just total fluid limitations.
Okay. But the oil and water production of the facilities at Prudhoe Bay has potentially a maximum of about 3.2 million barrels a day.
That's probably a pretty good number to use, yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead and continue.
Okay, now this, I think we've gone through the typical curves for production. And just to clarify a little bit, Mr. Chairman, in fact, even today, if we were to look at shale, what we would do from a reservoir engineering standpoint is we would look at models either Bakken or Eagle Ford or Marcellus or other areas that have got shale development. And we would take a real hard look at what kind of production profile they would have. And we would then use that as the cornerstone of our predictive models going forward for the shale developments in the state of Alaska. And that's typically what engineers will do is if they come into a new field, they will look at what kind of reservoir do they have? How big is it? How many wells do they think they're going to have to drill? Now, again, Prudhoe being Prudhoe, it's you know, the giant. So originally they had reservoir models. They were very simplistic models because they didn't have a lot of understanding of a lot of the geologic structure. But they would be able to even originally predict the plateau and the inception of the decline. So again, this is a very typical exhibit of a major oil field is that decline curve. General production facilities are listed in this table. It's a busy table. There's a lot of information. This is information that the division has been able to gather through discussions with various companies. It may or may not be fully up to date. We recognize that as one of the limitations. But in general, what we're trying to show is are there capacity limitations? And it didn't come across as well as I was hoping it would. Over on the far right-hand side, there are red and green bars. Unfortunately, it didn't come out as clear as I thought it was going to. The red bars indicate that there are limitations. So we can just pick almost any one of them. Let's just look at North Star, about a quarter of the way down from the top. It says limited gas handling and water production is limited uncertain whether rate capacity is current. I mean, this is the kind of information that we have garnished from the various companies in our ability to try and assess what are some of the limitations. Some of this information would be part of their POD, and as we work through the discussions with companies to try and understand, are they going to be installing more facilities? Are they going to be, are there reservoir modeling efforts to control gas? Are they effective? Are they going to have to put in gas handling facilities? How's the pressure maintenance going? All of these things get wrapped up into the general POD discussion. So you can see that there are very few of the facilities that have a green bar associated with them. Badami is an underutilized asset, and any development work in the Badami area that Savant might be doing or other companies nearby would very readily be willing to work some sort of production sharing and process facility sharing agreement. The last two, the Ugric and the Chiachuk, currently no limitations there. Now, the Ugric is also being processed through CPF3, which does have some limitations. So in part of the dialogue that we have had over the course of time has been this entire discussion swirling around facilities access agreements. And what I can tell you about facility access agreements is they are incredibly complicated agreements between sometimes competitive players.
If you could stop us, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to make sure I understand your chart on the previous page, I guess, the one with all the units and their capacities, et cetera?
Yes, sir.
If I'm looking at that right, flow stations 1, 2, and 3 and gathering centers 1, 2, and 3
yes, sir.
All have either gas handling limits or water handling problems at this point in time. Is that what we're saying?
That's our understanding, yes, sir.
So they're about limited to their production capacity total, regardless of what the combination of the makeup of what's flowing through them?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure I understood that. Thank you.
So, again, as we were talking about facility sharing agreements, these are very, very complicated, primarily, and Senator Thomas, to your kind of thrust part of your questioning, is if companies know that they have already got some limitations and they're trying to manage their own reservoir to the maximum efficiency of the reservoir management and to the capacity of their facility, and then a new player wants to come into that facility, it gets to be very complicated in terms of commercially and legally. If there's a facility shutdown, who's responsible for the loss or deferred production? Is it, and who gets backed out first? Who has the first rights to come back in? Are there penalty clauses? Does the state lean in and declare that there's a loss of revenue to the state? All of these things need to be considered in a general perspective of commerciality and influencing the overall direction of the companies have for the assets that they are managing. And it does then get involved in then the plan of development opportunities. So these are very complicated. And it also comes a lot to many companies have just an internal corporate culture that says they are going to build their own facilities and they're going to be self-sufficient. And again, that is part of a corporate culture. A lot of your companies would prefer to have smaller production facilities and then just ship oil through the existing pipeline network, then try and rely on somebody else to process their fluids. Now, that model works really well in a lot of places. I have actually worked in other countries where, especially, for example, offshore Norway, where using an existing offshore structure for the common good of many players is part of the program. They don't necessarily want to put up a lot of new platforms. They want to try and utilize the facilities they've got. So in that regard, they actually lease space on the platform itself to put on new facilities. But after a while, you can only hang so many things off the side of a platform. So Facility summary. Again, as the chair asked, Prudhoe and Kaparik are experiencing very typical reservoir depletion characteristics. These are, again, are very well managed properties. The gas reinjection, water flood, the municipal floods, all of those have garnished a great deal of benefits to the state. The companies are managing the assets they've got by turning wells on, turning wells off, watching which wells look like they're going to have too much water or too much gas, and they're trying to move that product around and at the same time manage reservoir pressure. Because the more you can manage reservoir pressure, the more recovery you're going to have, as well as where your gas fronts are and where your water fronts are during the gas flood and the water floods. The original facilities and the facilities they have to date are designed to meet a wide range of production profiles. As time goes on, those profiles do change, as exhibited by the current production. And the companies go through a series of retrofits, debottlenecking, workovers and recompletions on wells to recomplete to new horizons. They do water shutoff programs, gas shutoff programs, all of these on a well-by-well, area-by-area assessment. Pipeline systems, the capacity on the North Slope does exist. It is robust. And new players coming into the system should not have any problem about entering into the existing pipeline networks.
And again, it stopped there, but that you got to get it to the pipeline.
You have to get, well, on any new development, that you could lay a line from your production facility, you could lay your pipeline and tie into the existing infrastructure. Very similar to what Alpine did, tying into the Kaparik line to get to Pump 1. Mm-hmm. So it would be the same thing if Repsol has a discovery on their wells that they're drilling now, they would install their own production facilities, I would imagine, tie in, and from that production facility, they would tie into an existing line going into probably the Kaparik system going on into Pump 1. So every field is going to be managed and operated a little differently. It depends on the operator itself. But in general, every well has got to be hooked up to some sort of production system. You just can't flow a well straight into the pipeline, because every well is going to have some sort of either water or gas or sand and debris produced along with the oil. All that's got to be processed.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What involvement does the department have on the facilities agreements?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, actually very little. Those agreements are between the two parties. We do have the opportunity, if asked by either of the party, we can lean in and try and encourage that. Very seldom is the department engaged in those negotiations.
Does the department have any idea what it would take for facility upgrades to increase production?
Mr. Chairman, not at this time.
Does the department ever look at that?
Mr. Chairman, we take a look at, in the POD process, we look at what activities the companies are proposing relative to wells and facilities. So that's the opportunity that we have to look into whether they're going to be doing any upgrades or modifications of the existing systems.
So there's no information you can give the committee on the separation of below ground and above ground issues that could increase production? We spend a lot of time talking about basically below ground well workovers or infield drilling or what have you, very little time on facilities. So is it a facility constraint or below ground constraints we're dealing with, or what combination of both? And do you have any idea what it would take to stabilize production at 600,000 barrels a day?
Mr. Chairman, actually, it would probably take a combination of both, a combination of new exploration and new infield drilling to sustain the. And again, it's a very good point relative to a decline curve. Is the decline that we have today is actually a curve that has been arrested over time because of the infill drilling work. So because of the investments the companies have made, and because of the infill drilling, and because of the workovers, and because of the facility modifications, the decline we've got is actually at a lesser pace than it would be without that work. So it's the question to be a little bit broader is these the development of Prudhoe and Kuparuk and the associated PAs within those two units has actually been in a manner that has arrested the decline over and above what we would have had without additional work. So to flatten the decline even more, more wells would have to be drilled, more facilities would have to be installed or debottlenecking, additional gas handling facilities would be required by all parties, and then new entries to the market, Brooks Range, Repsol, E&I, Pioneer, any new developments, the heavy oil out of Milne Point, the Schrader Bluff, the oil shale with Great Bear and Royale, all of those would be part of the play, and all of those would need new facilities themselves.
And do you have any recommendations or advice to the committee on potential costs?
No, sir, I don't.
Senator Hoffman.
But knowing the decline of the fields that are inevitable, I don't think the department would have the information or make the judgment call, but it would seem that we are talking several hundreds of millions of dollars for increased facilities to address the potentially new oil going north to a million barrels. But is it going to be economical, or would it be more financially prudent to continue the way we are and not have the additional tens and or hundreds of millions of dollars of investment that the industry would have to incur? And I guess that's a question that we can't answer or you can't answer.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the North Slope Basin, including Kuparuk, Prudhoe, Alpine area, the foothills, well, the foothills is primarily a gas-prone area, the shale development area, and then east toward North Star and Badami. All of this area is still a tremendously robust, rich oil basin. The heavy oil that BP has been working on out near Milne Point, the recent well test they had at 650 barrels a day, is by far beyond world class in terms of heavy oil production from a single well. Those are the kind of developments, not just in singularity, but in aggregation of all the work that is going on, is what's going to be trying to drive the development beyond where we are today. Can we flatten it? Can we reverse the curve? I believe we can, but it will take a tremendous effort by the industry above and beyond what they're currently spending to achieve that goal. And the new development plays, the new exploration work, that is absolutely critical to get to where we're trying to get to.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to make sure, your statement on page 28 says that Prudhoe and Kuparuk units are experiencing typical reservoir depletion. Others indicate that it's a depletion at, or the decline, I guess they're a little bit different things, but that this is typical of what would take place. So obviously we're talking about building that up. So I just wanted to make sure that when you mention the third bullet point is pipeline capacity is available throughout most of North Slope. That pipeline capacity you're talking about is downstream?
Yes, sir.
Downstream, that's right. Because the other stuff is handling all the other gas and water that's being moved around and injected, re-injected?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, that's correct.
So with that in mind, do we truly need all of that water and gas injection at this point, or is it just that there's nothing else to do with that water? You can't put it back in the wells, or is that actually required to keep the pressure up? I'm assuming it is, but just thought I'd ask the question.
Through the chair, Senator Cummins, that is absolutely correct. And again, if you think back to the exhibit that I showed you relative to the Kaparik bubble map, and I was describing the line drive water flood, water flooding is a very viable technique for maintaining reservoir pressure. Then the more that you can, and the water itself is used is actually to sweep oil from an injector closer to a producer so the producer can produce it. Same thing with gas injection. There is tremendous benefit has been gained at Prudhoe for the reinjection of gas into the gas cap and actually moving oil from the upper elevations of the reservoir down into the lower producing horizon. So those are two very viable techniques. The water shutoff programs are going on. Kaparik has been, and both Prudhoe and Kaparik have been experimenting with techniques to literally shut off water downhole so that it won't migrate to other locations. So these are all reservoir management techniques and reservoir skills.
So with that in mind, then the only solution is to build more flow stations, gathering centers, central production facilities, whatever individuals may call them, because we are just constrained and not able to. We need that gas and water, so we have to reclaim it, so to speak, and put it back in the ground anyhow. And those facilities that are processing those are at their pretty much at their limits at this point in time.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, there's other areas of development as you progress more toward the west, away from the heart of the existing Prudhoe Bay area. Movement toward the west of that unit has still got some prospectivity. Those would be essentially some new facilities, but more importantly, they'd be new wells. And the overall drilling of the wells, you know, again, the water and the gas come out naturally, and then it's augmented by additional water in your general water flood. So you tend to almost compound the problem. Is to maintain the pressure for every barrel of oil you're taking out, you need to replace that with a barrel of water. So that's got to come from North Slope. It's coming from the ocean, you know, and that is a reinjection process to maintain that reservoir pressure and to move the oil to the producers. Okay. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that you're going to need more facilities at some point in time.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. President. In May of 1993, the Society of Petroleum Engineers Western Region meeting, engineers from BP and Conoco reported that, and I quote, BP, the Prudhoe Bay is seen as many as a maturing oil field on an inevitable and irreversible decline. The field's oil production capacity dropped below 1.5 million barrels a day in 1988. Officially signaling the start of the decline. On the onset of the decline was a direct result of limited gas handling capacity as opposed to limited oil production capacity. And I wonder if you agreed with that statement.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, what was the date that they said?
1993, the Society of Petroleum Engineers Western Regional Meeting.
And they said that decline started at what year? I'm sorry?
1988. Official decline was in 1988. And the onset of the decline was a direct result of limited gas handling capacity as opposed to limited oil production capacity.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, by everything that we have seen to date, I would tend to still agree with that, that the gas handling facility seems to be the bottleneck right now. Now, I say that, but we also need to remember that we need the gas, we need to be able to process the gas, and we need to reinject that gas to maintain reservoir pressure and sweep.
So several days ago, there was testimony from ConocoPhillips, and we're talking about increased production, and we're talking about, you know, 600,000 or 700,000 or a million barrels a day. And as I recall the testimony from their finance officer, it was technically impossible. So it was a technical issue to have substantial increases versus a tax issue. So one of the things we're struggling with here is you've got the technology constraint. If hypothetically, if your tax structure is zero, then you're going to have, you know, your capital invested to increase this production at some targeted level, and then the impact of your taxes completely pushing that break-even point down, and that's what we're struggling with, trying to separate what's technically feasible, what's feasible if there was a zero tax structure, and what's feasible under the current tax structure, and where are we between that zero and where we are today? Because we're not going to be at 1 million barrels a day. We're not going to be, some of us feel it would be difficult to get to 700,000 barrels a day. That's what we were talking about, I think, as I recall at the time.
But Mr. Chairman, there's been a lot of testimony, and a lot of things tend to at times get a bit misconstrued in the general dialogue. To try and think that the existing Prudhoe Bay Kuparuk fields, if that decline can be arrested and reversed to get to 1 million barrels, the answer is probably not. Now, that being said, Senator Hoffman's question relative to the rest of that general area, and my response is still that there is still a tremendous amount of oil to be discovered in the general North Slope Basin. That is still a target-rich environment. Those are the fields that while you can still employ some amazing technology, again, when Prudhoe Bay was discovered and people thought you were going to have a 30% recovery and the pipeline was going to be basically empty by the year 2000, here we are 2012, we're at 600,000 barrels a day. That is still well above beyond anybody's original concept of what was even technically able to be done at that point. 60% recovery in a reservoir is astonishing. So I don't discount the ability of engineers and geoscientists to come up with new and creative ways to develop oil and gas. It never ceases to amaze me the technical prowess that people will put to a problem when given an opportunity. So to say that we've got a 6% decline at Prudhoe today, to say that we can arrest that and bring it to, say, a 4% decline for a period of time, I think that's doable. Can we flatline Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk? It's possible. A lot of work has to be done. New technologies need to be brought to bear. New development concepts. Heavy oil in concert with the lighter oil that is needed to be used as a diluent to produce that heavy oil. Shale development. New conventional fields need to be brought online, need to be discovered and brought online. So all of those things are within the mix that needs to be brought to the table as we talk about the future development of North Slope, not just Kuparuk and Prudhoe in singularity. The work out of Badami with Savant, the work of Repsol, the work of ENI, Pioneer, Brooks Range, Great Bear, all of those need to be part of the equation that as we go forward and looking at overall developments of the North Slope. And those are robust. Those opportunities are tremendous.
But isn't like a 1 or 2% recovery rate in Prudhoe going to dwarf a lot of these other areas that you talked about?
Oh, absolutely.
Sheer magnitude of what we're dealing with?
Senator, you're absolutely correct. And that's why part of this dialogue needs to be couched along those same lines as well. You know, changing the decline profile of Prudhoe by 1%, even for a period of time, is an amazing feat. Just because it's just such a bloody big number. Mm-hmm. It's a huge field. And to do that with and to try and you know, do the right number of wells in the right locations with the right production facilities at the right time is really the dynamics associated with reservoir and production management.
Do we have any final questions for Mr. Barron before we move on to our next presenter? Seeing that, we're going to have an at ease while we set up for PFC Energy, and thank you, Mr. Barron.
Thanks, sir.
At ease. to go ahead and come back on the record this afternoon, and we're going to be running late because I'd like to get through this presentation today, however long it takes, and I'll break the committee at 3:15 for just kind of a stand-up so we don't go too long and then everybody's noodle shuts down and there's no attention. Today we're going to, we're joined by Mr. Janik Mayer of PFC Energy as a consultant, and we're going to continue to work on progressivity, and there's several options that we've talked about that he's going to go over, some of which will be more desirable than others, and we'll walk through this presentation. Some of it will be repeat, but I don't think that hurts a little bit. And we'll see how the flow goes. And after the meeting today, then hopefully I can speak to the committee members and we'll have a general idea where we want to focus in and which one of these options we want to take off the table. So, Mr. Mayor, if you want to introduce yourself for the record and tell us a little bit about PFC again, just for those watching at home that happen to turn it on, and give us a little background, and then take us through your presentation, please. And we'll probably stop you per slide like we've done in the past.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Janik Mayer. I am a manager in the upstream and gas practice of PFC Energy and project manager of this engagement we are undertaking for the state legislature on oil and gas fiscal terms reform issues. PFC Energy is a global energy consultancy focused purely on oil and gas issues, both upstream, meaning exploration, production activity, everything that occurs before crude oil, to get crude oil out of the ground, and downstream in terms of the refining, marketing, retail sectors. Our expertise is in particular on all of the above ground issues that companies face in oil and gas production, whether that be understanding markets and market analysis, whether that be political risk of different countries, whether that be understanding fiscal terms and the ways in which government sets the rules in the sense of the oil and gas game, and companies need to understand those rules in order to be able to play there. We work at the intersection in that sense of both of companies, international oil companies, that is, national oil companies, and governments. To start today, I wanted to put up a slide that, and I'll come back to this later in the deck, but that summarizes in terms of revenue to the state a number of the different fiscal options that we were looking at when last I testified on Friday, in the context both of ACES as well as HP 110, and then a few other permutations that we can get into and discuss today. To start by taking the macro view of things, ACES, of course, at around $100 price level, nets to the state purely in terms of production tax revenue by our model around $3.7 billion. HB 110, by contrast, substantially reduces that at that price level by around $1 billion or so. In the core of the analysis that we've done here, we have focused at the direction of the committee on options for base levels of taxation and progressivity and a few things around that slightly reduce government take at those levels, but don't dramatically reduce revenue to the state at those levels, but which significantly reduce progressivity beyond that point to further even the split of revenue between companies and government. We looked on Thursday in particular at how committee substitute for Senate Bill 192 might look if we, for instance, were to put a 50% rather than a 60% cap on the maximum rate. We looked at what it might look like if the base rate were raised from 25 to 30%, but progressivity substantially reduced to 0.2 and capped at 40%. Here, and we'll go through this in the slides, I've also looked at what committee substitute for Senate Bill 192 would look like largely as is, without the change in the base rate, but simply with that 40% cap. And one of the things you'll see here is there isn't actually, in some of these numbers, a significant difference between those two things. And then the other idea that we started discussing on Friday was this idea of, in fact, taking progressivity out of production tax altogether and instead making it a gross tax, essentially, a severance tax, or a tax on gross oil production net of royalty, in the terms that everyone is familiar with from the legislative language of both the bases and the current bill, gross value at point of production, essentially. There are a number of possible advantages in taking such an approach, given some of the issues which the committee appears to be seeking to address. One of those issues is, of course, the question of decoupling. As I spoke to in my testimony on Friday, the issue of decoupling comes about precisely because of the inclusion of progressivity in production tax. If production tax were a flat tax, the issue of decoupling wouldn't arise, simply because the question of gas production, particularly large volumes of gas production at low price, potentially, if and when gas is developed on the North Slope, reducing production tax by existing oil producers comes about because of the progressive nature of that slope, so that, of course, as oil prices and production tax value go higher, a higher tax rate is levied. So by returning production tax to a simple flat arrangement and instead incorporating progressivity at the gross level, one is able to solve the problem of decoupling without having to go into the administratively much more complex solution that is in CSSB 192, which is to say production and costs for oil and for gas have to be separated, and we need to find a mechanism of allocating costs to oil and costs to gas, and companies have to report these things and presumably, in essence, submit two different tax returns for these things. One can get away from all of that complexity of those two things simply by taking progressivity, stripping it out of production tax, and instead levying it at a gross level. That's what's referred to when, in a couple of these options, a severance tax, a progressive severance tax option is mentioned. There is, of course, a second benefit from the perspective of some of these things the committee is considering by doing so, which means it also creates significantly greater flexibility for finding ways to specifically incentivize new production, that as long as progressivity remains part of the base production tax, the profit-based production tax, are significantly more difficult. As we've talked about in a couple of sessions last week, in order to incentivize new production under the existing system, there are really only a couple of options. One can create a certain dollar amount allowance to be subtracted from production tax value for quote-unquote new oil. That can be, as we talked about last week, for production above last year's volumes, although as we've seen, that has relatively little effect. That can be production over some sort of rolling average base decline. That can be production above some sort of fixed base decline. That can be production from completely new areas. That can be production from new plans of development, and that can be part of the regulatory process. But however one defines that, the actual mechanism through the existing system for providing an incentive for these things is relatively complex. One either has to have some sort of allowance, or in the terms of one of the other possible amendments we've looked at, tax holiday for these sorts of things. Whereas if one, again, takes progressivity out of the base production tax altogether and instead makes it part of simply levied at a gross level, one has significantly greater flexibility with how one can deal with these things. So, for instance, if it were desired to do so, to provide a very high level of incentive for instance, completely new production from completely new areas. One could provide some sort of system, for instance, where that progressive severance tax only applied to existing fields, and for instance, entirely new areas could have no progressive severance tax whatsoever and only face the flat 25% base tax. Alternately, one could have a lower level of severance tax that applied either to new areas or to production over base or however one wanted to manage that. So I've tried to include a couple of these options here. In that sense, when one looks at them in terms of dollar value to the state, they're, of course, a hypothetical exercise. In the same sense, I've included here because I've, for context, since one is talking about ways of stimulating new production and incentives for new production included, the rates under HB110 for new production here. Of course, that in the instance of HB110, 15% rate would never be applied to all production in Alaska. So in that sense, looking at what does that mean in dollar value terms if we applied it to all production in Alaska is an analytical exercise that can be useful to see, but not reflective of reality. However, I wanted to include it in the table since I included all of those systems as we go through the slides. But that same principle applies to for the 6% severance tax option here and the 25% flat production tax options on the right. These are essentially options to think about how one might structure things under such a system to provide additional incentives for new production, whether from new areas, from new plans of development, or above some base decline curve.
Before you go on to the next slide, maybe explain to us a little bit on this slide what we're actually looking at here. You've got their severance portion, production tax revenue, you got the state take, and the bottom is total government take, or total government dollars, is that?
That's correct.
And then I was curious, there's the third component, which is the industry side. Why wasn't that put on the chart, or what's your thoughts there?
Mr. Chairman, if that is desired, we can certainly prepare that for the next session of which BSA presents.
Okay, yeah, in the table, it might be nice that we're looking at the whole thing, but on these revenue comparisons, are we looking at current production and legacy fields? Are we looking at the aggregate of everybody? Are we looking at new production? What are we looking at here?
Any time that revenue figures are presented rather than simply percentage of government take figures, that means we're simply running financial year 2013 data, including production levels and cost levels, through the model.
So this is FY13 data out of the revenue source book, mainly to get so that's the homogenized, as we've referred to it here. So when we go in and take a look at the legacy fields, and these numbers are going to move somewhat, and then when we look at the small producers that are consuming a lot of credits yet no revenue, it's going to be a different set of numbers. Then when we put them all together, we see what we see here. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So then later on, because I haven't had time, because you just flew into town right during the last presentation, so we haven't had time to walk through this. So so later on in the presentation, then, are we going to take a look at those different classifications and try to tie it together, or what's your... Where are you going to take us today?
Mostly, I today wanted to step through what some of these different regimes look like in terms of levels of government take and revenue to the state, and finish off as well looking at some analysis that we weren't able to look at last time of marginal rates under each of these.
Okay.
To start with, to present something that should now look fairly familiar to people, the existing system, one of course, for public benefit, I'll set out briefly what these charts are. They're of course probably very familiar to the committee by now. In the upper left, we have simply a cash flow analysis. In this case, this is looking at, very broadly speaking, as a stylized analysis for a 200,000 barrel a day existing producer, holding recent levels of cost constant with some escalation factor over time and a 6% decline curve, what does cash flow look like from this under the existing system? And that upper left graph is a graph of those cash flows, along with some basic economic metrics around net present value at different price decks of that portfolio. Top right, we have what government take looks like at different levels. In the red, we have total government take. So we see here, for instance, at $100, we have total government take under ACEs of around 75%, rising as high as 83%. If we go well beyond prices that we have seen so far into the 200s. The percentages here are all percentages of divisible income, so they sum horizontally to total state take or total government take. And then in the bottom two charts, we have, in the bottom right-hand side, we have those percentage level of government take figures graphed out, and then on the left, what that looks like in absolute terms in terms of actual dollars. So ACEs, of course, around 75% government take at $100, rising to, as we see, 83 at the very top of the price deck there. By contrast, if we step to the next slide, HB110 is a reference for what has been referred to by companies as sort of the threshold for meaningful reform. Cuts that all the way, for instance, to around 67% at the $100 level, and then really sees a maximum level of 70-71% as that sort of flattens out the curve as we get into the mid-hundreds. And we see, of course, correspondingly, the cash flow line rise on that chart and present value of that portfolio. Look by contrast at what the bill before the committee substitute for Senate Bill 192 looks like. We see really very little difference in government take below the $100 level. That 75 drops here to 74, although that's probably a function as much of rounding as anything else, I suspect. In reality, the change is even smaller than that. Where we do see change is in the uppermost levels of the price deck, where that sort of those figures of above 80% get flattened out at some point of the price deck to 79 or 80%. This is a life cycle analysis, and in that sense also incorporates the effect of inflation on some of these nominal thresholds. So we see that flattening out occur around the mid-hundreds. If we did this purely on a financial year 2013 basis, we would see that flattening out probably not occur until around, I think, the $230 level. So in that sense, relatively little difference between Senate Bill Committee substitute for Senate Bill 192 and ACEs as it currently stands. If we were to put the 50% cap that we discussed on Friday instead of the 60% cap that currently applies in the bill on the table, that then again keeps the local government take at $100 around the same, very slightly reduces it, but then keeps that sort of mid-70s level of government take flat, where under Senate Bill CS, Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 192, we see it continue to rise all the way up to 80% higher in the price deck. So it reduces the extent to which, as we've heard in testimony, high oil prices upside is reduced for companies investing in these fields. So but by bringing the 50% cap down, we start to reduce that effect, at least at very high price levels, above the $120, $130 level where we are today. It, however, doesn't have a particularly large effect at price levels below that. If one were to drop that cap even further, down, for instance, to 40%, what we then see is essentially a flattening out of levels of government take altogether, and a much more neutral system that essentially sees 69-70% as the rate that is carried across the board at almost all price decks. And correspondingly, in each of these cases, we see net present value for each of these portfolios rising.
But if we could stop there on page 7 on your net present value relative to currently ACES is at $40 is $28.12 and it's close to $25.88. So you can want to address this table up there a little bit for us?
Certainly, Senator. If we look at net present value under ACES at $40 a barrel versus Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 192 at $40 a barrel, we see in this case that, in fact, at $40 a barrel, the value of this portfolio is reduced under Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 192 in comparison to ACES. That is a function of one particular part of Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 192, which is, of course, the higher minimum level of tax that occurs in the bill. Instead of taking a 4% minimum with lower levels at lower price decks as exist in the system as it currently stands, that clause in CSSB 192 is replaced with one which sets a minimum of that for particular large producing assets, production tax can fall no lower than 10% of production of gross value. And that floor binding is what we see in the lower NPV that we see at $40. In all of the CSSB 192 options than we see under ACES. By contrast, at $60, the figures are largely similar, and that's simply a function of the fact that at $60, given these costs, progressivity has only barely started to come into play, but we see significant differences, or at least modest differences, at the $100 level. Mr. Chair, on the next slide, we have an option that was discussed in the committee on Friday, which is if one were to raise under CSSB 192 the base rate from 25 to 30%, but substantially lower progressivity from 0.4 to 0.2%, and my apologies, that's a typographic error in there, that should be 0.2%, not 0.02%. As well as putting in place a 40% cap. What does that look like? And one of the things I wanted to show through this analysis and comparing it to simply CSSB 192 with a 40% cap is to show that actually there's, at most price levels, there is relatively little difference because of where that cap starts to bind and certainly, obviously, from the point that cap binds onward, levels of government take that we see are identical, and in this case, levels of net present value that we see for those portfolios above the $100 level is almost identical. What we do see, however, is at lower price levels, of course, the 35% base rate worsens economics, of course, because in those circumstances, particularly as we get down to price levels where progressivity has only just started to impact, what one has is that the impact of that higher base rate, which, of course, can make further marginal, particularly, for instance, around the $60 level, economics of projects that may already be so. So in this case, if we compare CSSB 192 simply with a 40% cap on the previous slide to the higher base rate, reduced progressivity, and the 40% cap, we see a notably reduced present value at that price. By contrast, we see relatively little difference at even lower price decks, for instance, at $40 oil, for the simple reason that, again, in this case, at the $40 case, the floor binds, and that ultimately is what is setting government take, not the progressivity scale or the base rate.
So it's the $50, $60, $70 range at this 30% base rate starts pushing the present values underwater?
That's exactly correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Now, as we will see in some slides later, the one possible benefit, of course, of that increase in the base rate to 30% is some reductions in the marginal rates that we see under the production tax system, and high marginal rates has been one of the things sort of flagged in Tasmania and other things as one of the problems with the system. I however, would strongly suggest that as significant a problem as marginal rates are, to address them with a solution that, particularly in that $50 to $70 range, actually worsens economics on projects may be a solution with a worse impact than the problem which it solves. To illustrate that point a little further, I wanted to include just a few slides looking at those couple of scenarios of the 50% cap, the 40% cap, and the 40% cap with reduced progressivity but an increased base, and show again what those look like, for instance, for the new development that we have been discussing. And similarly, what we see is at both those $40 and those $60 levels, a notable worsening of net present value in the 30% base rate case. So if we start with on slide 9, first of all, looking at the 50% cap in the case of a new development, the 40% cap on the following slide in the case of a new development, and then finally, on slide 11, the 30% base rate, the 0.2 progressivity, and the 40% cap. What we see again is that same significant worsening of net present value, particularly around the $60 level, although in this case we also see it at the $40 level because, of course, as the language in CSSB 192 sets out, the floor level of production tax value is one that applies to large existing fields as opposed to smaller new developments like this. So in that sense, the negative impact of the higher base for new developments extends all the way down the price deck because it's not obscured by the question of the floor level of taxation. Finally, to proceed to the question of what this would look like if instead we took out progressivity from the production tax and instead created a separate item, progressive severance tax, which is, again, as I say, a tax based solely on production volumes, progressive over price. In this case, what I've modelled, and I've tried to spend some further time since testifying on Friday examining how different progressivity thresholds and rates for such tax might work. In this case, what's modelled is something that is a severance tax levied on gross value at the point of production. So all prices quoted here are prices net of transportation. In that sense, again, under the definition of the legislation, gross value at the point of production. And what's being taxed are those gross volumes net of royalty. What's modelled here is a tax that starts at a zero rate and only kicks in at the 70% level, sorry, at the $70 level, $70 gross value at point of production. And with each dollar increment above that $70 level, increases by 0.25% to get, I think, to a maximum of a local maximum of about 16% at $130, and then increases at a lower progressivity rate of 0.1% up to $180, where it reaches its maximum of 20%. What we see here is a government take curve that is not dissimilar to the government take curve that we have on the previous page, or more comparably, on page 8 or page 7, the two options, slide 8 or slide 7, the two options dealing with the 40% cap. So this is essentially a severance tax set up to have a similar government take profile to that system, but one which, as we said, allows an easier way of addressing the decoupling issue and allows particular incentives to be made for new production. So what we see here in that slide on page 12, our graphs now have an additional purple bar where the yellow of the production tax is now a relatively, has a flat profile because, of course, it's simply a flat 25% production tax. But what would otherwise be an overall slightly regressive regime because of the impact of the fixed royalty and makes it ever so slightly progressive but largely fixed around a 70% government take level is that progressive severance tax kicking in at the $70 level.
So before you run to another slide, Janik, a couple things on this one. The NPV at 40 looks like it's worse than under the existing ACEs, existing producers. Are these the, make sure I'm looking, they're two different data sets.
Mr. Chair, if we compare that both to
Slide three
of ACEs for an existing producer and slide 5 of CSL 3192 for an existing producer, what we should see is that net present value in the $40 case should be largely similar to that under CSSB 192.
What slide? You're looking at slide 3, and what was the other one?
Slide 5.
Slide 3 and 5. Okay. Give me a second to turn to it. Yeah, 3 and 5, but comparing, how do you tie in slide 12? And again, remind me how these things are run on slide 12. Slide 3 is?
Is ACEs under the existing, ACEs for an existing producer. Slide 5.
Yeah, but it's ACEs under the existing producer with 200,000 barrels a day, roughly.
That's correct.
Production.
Slide 3, slide 5, and slide 12 are all done on that basis.
Okay.
What we see, for instance, if we compare slide 12, this is the severance tax option, to slide 5, is that at $40 a barrel, we should have an almost identical net present value. Where we have a decreased present value is compared to ACEs, and that's because, at least as modeled, this has worked from the basis of Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 192, and again, what you're seeing there is the impact of the higher price floor under Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 192. If that were taken out, what we would see is a present value figure almost identical to ACEs.
Okay, so it's the floor that moves the NPV down from 2812 to 2587.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, effect of the floor. Just so I understand your slides.
Absolutely.
Okay, and then later on we could run, I would imagine your model can run a rather than a 40, 60, 100, you can run them at $10 increment from 40 up or whatever we, our little heart's desire.
Indeed, we can.
And then back on this lower right-hand chart on page 12, just make sure I'm interpreting it right. Basically, at $130, the split of profit oil between the producers and the state stay constant.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
So then both dollars increase as the price advances. And or decrease.
Precisely.
Okay. I think that was one of the major issues we've been struggling with here, how to deal with that split of profit oil at high oil prices.
Okay. Now, as I laid out, one of the advantages to taking progressivity out and making it that gross progressive tax instead of having it be part of production tax is, as we said, the issue of decoupling. The other is the question of ways in which one could incentivize new production. And so on the following two slides, what I wanted to look at is two options for doing that. Now, we can start by thinking of this in the context of, for instance, regimes of what might put in place for production from entirely new areas, for entirely new producers. One approach to that might be to say, well, one would like to offer improved terms for that sort of production by reducing the severance tax from the maximum of 20%, for instance, in this case, down to a maximum of 6%. So what's been modeled here, for instance, is what that would look like if we were, again, to start with a zero base and have 0.05% progressivity from 170 to 190, and then have it be flat 6% from 190 onward. And we then get into government take figures for those sorts of developments that are around the mid-60s. One could, even if one wanted to, go further and say, in fact, for entirely new developments, these are things on which we're not losing any existing revenue and we really do want to find a way of incentivizing. And, for instance, take out the progressive severance tax altogether and have nothing but the 25% flat production tax. That would see a reduction in those levels of government taken down a little further, even to the 63-62% level. One could do that on an indefinite basis. One could do that for a particular time-limited basis, say, for instance, for the first 10 years of production. No progressive severance tax, simply the 25% flat production tax. Then as part of that, what one might want to consider is, of the three possibilities that we've discussed last week of types of new production that one would want to incentivize, for instance, production from new areas being the simplest, production from agreed plans of development for particular initiatives, or if one wants to take the approach of saying of setting some particular decline curve and saying all production above that will have a particular preferential treatment. Again, for any of those options, one could have some combination or either or a lower severance tax structure or indeed severance tax taken away altogether, either for a shorter period, either for a given period of time, 5 years, 10 years, or for an indefinite period of time, depending on how great an incentive one wanted to provide for each of those categories of new production. And by taking progressivity out of the production tax system and instead loving it on gross production, it enables that to occur because, of course, one is no longer trying to figure out for each of these different streams of production what were the costs associated with them and therefore do this complex accounting that has to go into production tax for each of these. It's simply a question of how many barrels were produced and what was the oil price. Mm-hmm. To come back then to that chart where we started, and again look at the dollar figures associated with some of these options, to focus on production tax revenue and to focus at initially at the $100 level. $3.7 billion or so under the current system versus, again, as that benchmark for quote-unquote meaningful reform, about $2.7 under HB 110. What the three options modelled on CSSB 192 do is essentially reduce that slightly from the 3.6, 3.7 level to more like 3.5, just over. Below 60, at 60 and below, for the two options that keep the base level the same, at the $60 level, the results are identical to ACES. At the $40 level, the results are higher because of the impact of, again, that higher floor under CSSB 192. And then at levels above 100, again, as a result of that flattening out, of the system and the reduction in progressivity, what we see is significantly less revenue from production tax to the state at those extremely high price levels. To look briefly at the severance tax example, and this is something, again, that we can do further working with, further massaging of exact levels of what point a severance tax might kick in, whether it has a zero base, whether it has a small base, what its progressivity coefficient might be. And here we have, again, because we have the at the $40 and $60 levels, identical figures, because, again, at those levels, all that's occurring are the 25% base, which is common to all of these. At $100, in this case, we have reduced revenue down to a little over $3 billion, but then in the $150 and $200, actually very similar levels of revenue to some of the other capped CSSB 192 variants that we're looking at. And then, again, just for the sake of analysis, though it's not accurate to think of this as being revenue to the state of Alaska, for particular fields that one were to incentivize through a lower severance tax rate or through no severance tax rate and purely flat production, purely for numeric comparison, they're not, again, as I say, as a question of what they would look like for revenue to the state of Alaska. We have what those reduced numbers look like and how they compare, for example, to the reduced rates, in particular the 15% reduced rate under HB 110 for new production.
So if we take a look at the severance tax concept with a 20% maximum in the 0.25 progressivity for $70 to $130, which is basically the third column over from the right. But at $100 a barrel, there's a significant spread between 7.2 and 6.6. So what would it take on the severance tax model to get fairly close to the $100 cash position that we're currently under ACES, because we've had testimony that at $100 a barrel, we're in pretty good shape, but north of there, it starts to deteriorate, and as we get in, you know, into extremely high prices, it gets even worse. So, did you run it anything north of this progressivity rate of 0.25 to some other number, or could you do that for the committee?
I can certainly do that for the committee, Mr. Chair. I've looked at a number of rates, and this structure was, in my first cut of things, the closest I got to matching, in particular in terms of percentage government take figures. But I think with some further massaging of that, we could get that closer to the levels of revenue that we see at the $100 rate. That may be done through not having a zero base rate for the severance tax, but in fact a small base rate, and some combination of that with the changes to the progressivity regime.
Right, because I think the steeper the progressivity, the impact on marginal tax structure creeps in.
Mr. Chairman. And so it was taken into account a number of those things that led me to start at least with this particular proposal, but we can try and refine that further.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, and can we have them run between $10 increments between 100 and 150.
Yes.
You can see that.
And then maybe we could run that. I think there's a fairly good chance that north of 150, that split of profit oil is going to be frozen. So I think maybe we should, yes, maybe spread that to 60, 150.
Yeah.
It's maybe $60 to $150 on that.
Suddenly, I can do that. To look then graphically on the next slide, what that looks like in terms of levels of revenue from production tax, in this case including severance tax in the two cases that include that. The top two lines we have here are, of course, ACES and CSSB 192, with very little difference between them. The next line down being the navy blue line with the diagonal crosses on it is what CSSB 192 would look like if we brought the cap down from 60% down to 50%. And so, of course, from, in this case, around the $140 level, it's identical largely to, it is identical to CSSB 192 and then diverges from that point onward. With the $40 cap, we have the pink line with the vertical bar, which is again, identical with CSSB 192 to about the $110 level, and then diverges from that point onward. What we have in that case, for instance, if we compare this again as a reference to HB 110, is significantly higher revenue from that at the $110, $120 level, and then sort of convergence with HB 110 from sort of the $180, for instance, price level onward, and in fact slightly less revenue than HB 110 from around the $180 mark onward. To look at the severance cases.
All right. When you're done with slide 16, we're going to stop just for a couple minutes, have a little stand-up break, and then we'll start again.
Look at the severance cases. The light pink is our primary severance case example. In this case, what we see is in the high price levels, it's a little above HB 110, but converges at the top of the deck, but is much closer to CSSB 192 at the $100 level or so. Finally, to look at the bottom of the spectrum of this chart, we have what some of the incentives for new production could look like. So in this case, for instance, first of all, in the electric blue with the triangle marker on it, we have what it looks like for HB 110 with the incentive for new production as a comparison to what it would look like with the 6% maximum severance tax. And so in this case, we have revenue from productions around the $160 level being higher than under the really very low level of taxation and tailed under HB 110 for new production because of the 15% base that entails. But then at the highest price levels, some similarity with that, in fact, coming slightly below that HB 110 for new production at the highest levels. And finally, what it would look like for just a 25% flat production tax for new fields. Again, because the 25% rate, a little higher, for instance, than that which occurs under the 15% rate under HB 110 for new production, but from $130 onwards actually being a lower level of taxation than under that entailed for new production under HB 110.
And then just as a reminder on this chart, this is the 200,000 barrels a day production.
This is all based on any analysis that includes dollar figures is all based on FY 2013 numbers.
Okay, so this is 2013 numbers.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're going to stand at ease for a little break so that we all don't go to sleep, and we'll come back here in about 3 to 5 minutes. We're at ease. I'd like to go ahead and come back on the record, please. We're going to pick up on page 16 of the presentation, or probably 17, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, to move on to 17, I think we probably don't need to spend any significant time on slide 17 itself unless there are particular questions. 17 is simply showing the data equivalent to slide 16, but for total state take versus specifically production tax. It's a similar story with less differentiation because, of course, one has the other sources of revenue that accrue to the state. So unless there are particular questions on that, I will move on to slide 18. This set of slides simply looks at the question of marginal take under each of the regimes we've examined. Of course, one of the particular criticisms of the existing ACES system is how high marginal government take can be, particularly at around current price levels. So, for instance, and this is looking not just at the production tax component, but at all of the components of the regime combined together. What we see is a peak in marginal government take of more than 90% at price levels that are essentially where we are today in terms of ANS West Coast crude pricing. So for every dollar increase at the moment that occurs in ANS West Coast crude, of that dollar increase at the moment, the state of Alaska captures 90%.
But pretty quick, that'll decline. And then I think when we have that, some of these options worked on some more, maybe we can have, we've got the marginal tax issue, but maybe we can have the effective tax rate put on the charts too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
If we instead briefly again, simply by way of a reference comparison, look at HB 110. HB 110, of course, puts in place a bracketing system, and that system of bracketing is what enables it to substantially reduce the marginal levels of take. So, in fact, what we see here is essentially levels of government take below 70% across the entire range. I'm not keeping up with my slides. That was on slide 20. If we move on to the next slide, slide 21, and look at what Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 192 looks like, essentially it looks very similar to WACES. Again, we have that peak above 90%, really the only impact of the changes with CSSB 192 versus ACES is that the peak at which that occurs ever so slightly later because of the 0.35 rather than the 0.4 coefficient. So instead of the prices that we have today, it happens more at the prices that we had a few weeks ago. To look at what then happens if we put in cap in place a 50% cap, again, not a significant difference on the marginal peak. Instead, what we see is after that local peak around, in this case, the $130-odd level is achieved, marginal take, of course, flattens out because from that point onward, we no longer have further increasing progressivity. We instead have, at that point, a flat 50% rate taking hold. If we reduce it to 40%, we start, in fact, to address some of the marginal issue, at least in part. We still obviously have that peak that is characteristic of the non-bracketed progressivity system, but that peak is somewhere in the low 80s instead of at 90% and above, simply as a result of putting in place the 40% maximum. If we look at what happens with the example that was requested for analysis of raising the base to 30% and reducing the slope on progressivity, what we see is by doing so we further reduce marginal take, in this case now down into the mid-70s. But as I covered further in my testimony, of course, the negative impact of that is worsened project economics for all assets, particularly around the $60 level, and in particular for smaller, higher cost developments that, for instance, may not trigger progressivity even at relatively high prices because of their high cost structure. Finally, to look at the severance tax example, in this case the 20% maximum tax. Again, we can, following that structure, we get peak marginal tax rates no longer in the low 90s, but instead in around the 80% rate. And for instance, to take one of the examples of a lower rate that might be used to incentivize certain categories of new production, where it's at a 6% maximum severance tax rate, that, of course, comes down even further. And finally, to no one's surprise, if all one has, particularly for particular categories of new production, is a flat 25% production tax, then we have an entirely flat marginal government take, only very slightly over the 60% mark. Finally, Mr. Chair, to look at our previous competitiveness analysis of where different regimes sit in a global context. Before I talk to the data points in the slide, I want to point out that there is, in fact, an error in one data point, which I will provide a corrected version for the committee, which is HB 110 here is down extremely low. The reason for that, I'm almost certain, is that the 15% rate for new production rather than the 25% base has been applied. It should, in fact, be around the 67% rate on this chart, not the low 60s as it currently stands. My sincere apologies for that error.
Well, that could be reprinted sometime in the future. I think we're going to be asking for some modifications to a couple of these and some of this chart and then more data run. For instance, there might be more than one option that we have you work on, but clearly this severance tax of the 20% maximum with a 0.25% progressivity on the gross, that option, which is the third one in on your third one in on your major chart. But I think we need to tweak those numbers a little bit and work with the balance between the marginal and the effective tax rates and bring that into reasonably close to no cash change at $100 a barrel.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. On this, what we see, of course, is, as we've seen before, with ACES for an existing producer, we are only a little bit below Norway. The highest taxing jurisdiction in the OECD. As we implement caps on progressivity, 50% and then 40%, we take that down to government take levels closer to the 70% mark, and as a result bring Alaska further down this deck. As it's currently structured at the moment, the 20% maximum severance tax option that we've been looking at puts Alaska just above, for instance, the highest, as we have them here, of the North America onshore producers. So where unconventional production from the Haynesville in Louisiana, we see government take of in the high 60s for here under the severance tax with a 20% maximum, we get to about 69%, though that might increase slightly based on the wishes of the chairman just outlined now, as we do further analysis on how that might work. And then finally, to just again, for the sake of comparison, if one looks at, for instance, what purely the 25% flat production tax, if offered as an incentive, for instance, for incremental production from new fields, or incremental production rather from existing fields, what that might look like for that particular incremental production, one could then get a government take figure well into the very competitive range of the low 60s if one were to offer that particular form of incentive for incremental production.
Right. Or just the effect of a base 25% base tax with no progressivity, just so we understand how that looks versus the tax structure when we have progressivity in place. We have questions for Janik or things you guys would like to, and Gal would like to have run. I'm going to have him change the x-axis, bring it into $150 a barrel so we can get zero it in a little bit more and then work with the one option, the severance tax on the gross, work that a little bit more, bring back to us the marginal and effective tax rates, some comparisons in both percentages and then in dollars. He just flew in from East Coast today, so he'll be up early our time working on this and have some new data for us in the morning, I'm sure.
Mr. Chairman, I'll see what I can do.
Okay. We have any other questions for him before we cut him loose? Okay, Janik, thank you for coming in today. And I'll get with you right after this meeting, and then we'll continue on this process. This afternoon's meeting adjourned. Tomorrow, I think we have public hearing. Isn't that right, Mr. Co-Chair, on the
yes.
operating budget? So we'll have a public hearing, and then we'll be working on this bill tomorrow in my office. So any of the committee members want to put 2 cents in or more than that, I'm interested in having some input. And we are adjourned.